Hello, and thank you for listening to this recording of Business Forward's conference call on S&P's new report, The Key to Unlocking U.S. GDP Growth, Women. In this recording, we are joined by Beth Ann Bovino, the Chief U.S. Economist for S&P Global Ratings Services. To access the report, please visit bit.ly/women_GDP. That's bit.ly/women_GDP, all lowercase. If you would like to attend our next conference call live, go ahead and sign up at businessfwd.org. Again, that's businessfwd.org. The first voice you will hear is Elizabeth Kerr, Policy and Communications Director with Business Forward.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining today's conference call. I'm Elizabeth Kerr with Business Forward, and I'll be moderating our conversation today. Currently, all lines are in listen-only mode. We're here today to talk about a recent report from S&P Global that suggests women are the key to unlocking U.S. GDP growth. We have the study's main author, Beth Ann Bovino, who is the chief economist at S&P Global Ratings. This is an interactive phone briefing, so after the presentation, we're going to open it up to your questions. For those of you who are new to Business Forward, we organize local roundtables, Washington fly-ins, conference calls, webinars, and media trainings for more than 100,000 business leaders across the country. And at these briefings, entrepreneurs, investors, small business owners, and executives all get the chance to brief policymakers and issue experts on issues that affect their businesses and how Washington can work better with businesses to accelerate the economy. To date, more than 600 mayors and governors, members of Congress, and senior administration officials have participated in our programming. And this is all thanks to the support of more than 60 of America's largest and most respected companies and foundations. Before we get started, I need to cover a few housekeeping items. First, this call is on the record. The call invitation was widely distributed to our network of 100,000 business leaders, and we also have had it on our social media channels. So the general public or media may be present on the call. That also means, though, that we are able to record this call, so we'll release it as a podcast later this afternoon. This is, as I mentioned, an interactive phone briefing, and there will be time for you to ask questions and share your advice with Beth Ann and her colleagues on this study. And you can do that in one of two ways, and their follow-up work. You can do this in one of two ways. First, you can press 1 at any time on your telephone keypad, and you'll be able to ask your question live. Or you can email your question to us at info@businessfwd.org. So when you push 1 on your phone, it raises your hand in the system, and I'm able to call on you. When you're called on to ask that question live, please introduce yourself with your business and where you're calling from, and please, if you email us a question, include that same information. So again, if you'd like to ask a question or provide a comment or share one of your experiences, you can do that by pressing 1 on your telephone keypad, or you can send that question to us at info@businessfwd.org, and I'll read that aloud for you. With that, I'm going to hand it over to Beth Ann Bovino. Beth Ann, go ahead.
So thank you, Liz, for having me on, and also thank you for the promotion. I'm the U.S. Chief Economist, but now I've just become global. Thanks, I appreciate that. Let me talk about the report that we did, Women in the Workforce. What we came out, there are overarching message is that if we saw more women participating and being retained in the U.S. workforce, there would be significant economic events along with political, potentially societal ones, and that would be realized over the next few decades. And why, as a U.S. chief economist, why did we focus on that? Well, right now the labor participation rate is at or near a 40-year low. That's been increasingly becoming a drag on growth. S&P Global U.S. Economics recently had lowered its estimate for potential long-term average growth. Now it's just at about 1.8%. That's 1% lower than where it was just 15 years ago. And the major reason is retirees. And retirees, while you've already seen the baby boomers starting to leave, they're only halfway through. That's going to be a 10 to 15-year process. Now, for women in the workforce, what we've noticed as well is that women's labor participation rate also seems to be in a decline. In 1990, prime age female participation rate was near the top of 22 advanced OECD countries in 1990. That would be, and when I say prime age, that's between the age of 25 and 54. So kind of, you know, taking out a lot of the student activities and sort of really a time when a lot of people that age are have a household, have children, are really managing a big factor. So they were, in 1990, they were near the top, at around 6 or 7 of 22 OECD countries. As of 2016, we're nearly in last place. And that's not good when we're trying to optimize what is considered to be the economy's most valuable research labor. We have noticed, and one of the big, we think one of the biggest factors for women, for holding women back in the workforce is basically being able to manage, you know, childbearing and rearing. The U.S. is the only country in the OECD that does not provide income support during maternity or paternity leave by law. And for single mothers, a full day care of child care for an infant eats up about 40% of median income. We're just talking about child care here now. Women also do the lion's share of family care, not just taking their kids to soccer games. That doesn't end when after 3 months after a woman delivers or gives birth, but also in terms of elder care, taking elderly parents to the doctor's appointments. All this means women are missing corporate networking dinners or rounds of golf with senior partners, holding them back over the long run. That ultimately ends up in a time-off penalty to bonuses, to wages that keep women from climbing the corporate ladder. What we've noticed, and one of the things that we wanted to look at, is what if, since we've seen women participation slowing much slower than many of our peers in advanced countries, we wanted to see what if women kind of kept the pace up of entry into the workforce at something that we've seen in other countries like Norway or some of the other doesn't have to be Norway, it could be Sweden, it could be Canada, it could be other countries that are way ahead of us. What would we see? We tracked on Norway. We found that if over the last three decades women's participation rate had increased at a faster pace, similar to levels seen across other advanced countries, the U.S. will be $1.6 trillion bigger than it is today. That, to put it in perspective, that's $5,000 for each person in the United States, man, woman, and child. Now, we also talked about some of the potential societal gains. Women save more and invest more in their children than men. Also, bringing the other half into the workforce would also help the U.S. address its growing long-term issue of an aging workforce. There's many other things. One thing, of course, to add to this is that, you know, giving women this economic freedom also means that's more freedom to invest. And given that women are very wise investors, this is a real positive going forward. We wanted to look at a few other things in terms of how we would handle this. We understand that this debate has been going on for a while, and we don't necessarily claim that we know all the answers, but we did want to kind of throw out a few ideas that we thought would be interesting. One of them was kind of looking at first increased education and advanced training for women and girls. That doesn't just mean, you know, college. We're talking going even earlier. When you think about it, how many Alberta Einsteins or Carla Sagans are missed in science, technology, engineering, and math research because we didn't offer the opportunities for the women and girls to develop these skills? You even have to consider that the Rosie the Riveter probably needs an advanced training in engineering to work with a very high-tech, modern tech manufacturing world. We've noticed recently some of the, in our studies, we found that a couple of things that really did kind of really shoot women, I think, and girls in education and really developing their skills in education was that Title IX took effect in 1979. That guaranteed that, basically that one couldn't be excluded because from an educational program merely on the basis of gender. There was also the Women's Education Equity Act, which also supported training girls in math, science, and other programs. All positive. A lot of these now have been dramatically cut. that's not all the cure-all. We don't want to just focus on education because, as I mentioned, there's that time-off penalty as a factor as well. Say you get a degree in STEM research. How do you manage your work at home, taking care of the children and elderly parents, and climb that corporate ladder? So there's still not answers there. Still not full answers. Still needs to be addressed. That's why we went to our second point, which is, what if we introduced some kind of Congressional Budget Office CBO-like score? Doesn't have to be part of the CBO, but something like that, that would help lawmakers be able to assess the impact, sort of a cost-benefit ratio, of a certain legislation and how it affects women in the workforce, their decision-making, and overall potential economic impact, including job creation. Now, this is something they've done before. They did it with ACA. They found that more than 2 million people would decide not to work by 2023. This is back in, I think, 2010 or 12. It wasn't that they lost their job. It was a decision because they had other options. So these are things that we were kind of mulling over and would love to keep the conversation going.
Thank you for that overview. It's really valuable. As a reminder to everybody on the call, if you'd like to ask a question, please press 1 on your telephone keypad, and I will call on you to ask that question live, or you can always email your question to us at info@businessfwg.org. We've got a couple email questions I'm going to get started with, and then we'll move on to some live questions. Could you talk a little bit about whether or not, Beth Ann, these results vary across different types of jobs? I think we've talked a lot about the possibility of STEM jobs and how perhaps lower-income women face bigger challenges. But how do some of the GDP results, how are they affected by different positions that women hold in different kind of sectors of the economy?
So the question would be sort of how, you know, so we're giving you a kind of a overarching story, I guess you could say, in terms of the impact of women in the workforce. And so the question is, how would this change if, for different parts of the economy, different sectors in the economy, different types of jobs that women can take? Is that what you're saying?
I believe so, yes. Thank you.
Okay, so in terms of that, now what we did in our analysis, we looked at we kept it very much general. If we increase the women's participation in the workforce on par with a country, one of the top countries that that have many women in the workforce, we used Norway, but others could be used as well. If we followed that path that those countries had taken, we'd have a much stronger economy today than we saw than we have right now. The $1.6 trillion. We did not make any adjustments for sort of that seat at the table, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. What if, and that we think, while we don't have an exact number on that, we think that the economy would be even stronger. If indeed we saw, you know, given that we have at this point in time a very low productivity, low productivity levels for the United States, what if we saw, going back, we started our analysis, our scenario, started in 1970 and went up to today, but what if we saw not only did women enter the workforce at a faster pace, but what if they took a seat at the table, for example, in STEM jobs, STEM-type fields? We think that the economy would be much bigger, and it would make a dent, we think, in terms of that equity pay gap, I guess, as what was mentioned. However, we think that even if, you know, women decided to pursue, girls and women decided to pursue STEM fields, there is the other issue, which has nothing really to do with education, and that's the time off penalty. You know, if you're in science, technology, engineering, and math, you're putting in overtime. And the worry, of course, I think for the women who have maybe thought to pursue that course of work, would they be penalized if they have to leave early and take their kid to soccer practice or other factors? That also is something that holds them back, even if they pursued those educational careers, those educational fields.
Thank you. Following up on the comments that you made about parental care as they age and kind of just talking now about soccer practice and child care as kids are growing up, did you see any or examine any difference between, for instance, a motherhood gap and a women's gap in general?
find anything there, or is there anything that you think you might study in the future?
So in terms, so your question in terms of parental care, did my team study the gap between motherhood and just women in the workforce in general?
Yes.
So we have not explored that. We sort of, we're dealing with kind of large aggregate data, so we haven't been able to really fine-tune that to really kind of really get a sense of what's happening in terms of choices by that women make. We did seem to say that it was more likely in our analysis that it would be tied to kind of the cost-benefit choice that women usually women who are considering motherhood would have to make in terms of staying in the workforce or not. We think that would be a very, very interesting interesting next report, let's put it that way. I think that would be a very, very interesting thing to explore.
What advice would you have for companies who want to get ahead of the curve on this and take advantage of the qualified women who currently might not be being used to their full potential? Do you see a competitive advantage here available for companies that really get out front on this? And I think in conjunction with that question, we have another one from Susan Hearns in St. Louis asking, what are other industrialized nations doing that the U.S. is not to attract women into the workforce? Those seem to go hand in hand to me. I'll let you take it, Bethann.
Okay. Okay, so the two questions. Well, let me make sure I understood the first one, because the line is, while I can hear everybody, it's still a little sketchy. The question was, companies, how can they get ahead of the curve in terms of looking at women participation in their company? Is that what the
What advantage could companies perhaps find? Is there an advantage for companies that get ahead of the curve on this and really do what they can to attract and retain these qualified women who seem to be underutilized?
I see. Okay. I think that there's a couple of things that companies can do in terms of getting ahead of the curve. This also goes back to Uncle Sam too. That I'll get into too as well. You know, I mean, so how can companies, let's say, get ahead of the curve in terms of attracting and attaining and retaining, holding on to the women qualified women that they invest in? I think that companies, two factors that they could take. One would be that they, you know, considering that women, and this will go to Uncle Sam as well, but women, when you think about women's participation rate in the workforce or at their company, they're an investment. Companies are investing in that woman and the skills that they have for a longer-term period in terms of getting the benefits that they could get. Now, when we have short-term, you know, family leave for either for a child or for other factors, rather than thinking of that as a cost, think of it as something that's an investment to really retain the woman for later on. Indeed, there could be, in a sense, if a company makes the environment, the corporate environment, easy for the women to be able to manage some of those issues on the home front and continue to work in the office, there might be job, you know, basically job commitment. And in a sense, that woman may feel more loyal to that company than otherwise. Maybe that company loyalty will really make that woman want to work harder and produce even more for that particular firm. Another thing is, let's say for a large company that's public or in the news, this is great PR. You know, this is something, if you are a company that says, look what we do for women and how we make it these flex hours for women and to be able to manage both home and work and exceed in both places, that's a wonderful, wonderful commercial for that company to go on. Other women would want to go there. And, you know, and that could be a win-win for all. That goes to the Uncle Sam story. I think policymakers seem to think that maternity leave, for example, or paternity leave is a cost. We think of it more as an investment. You know, maternity and paternity leave doesn't last that long. It goes, you know, it is a few months, but if we can keep that woman and man, for that matter, retained and tied to the workforce, the long-term gains from that woman in the workforce making, and also her wages, means more money, more economic activity, and more money for Uncle Sam in terms of tax revenues. On that second question, I think the question was, what are other industrial economies doing? I think, was that the question?
It is. Yeah, I think it's a great pitch of what companies can do. Yeah.
Sure. So in terms of what other companies, I mean, countries are doing. I think you said countries, like.
Yeah.
Okay. So here's where we see where the kind of the gap had started to widen. We did see that women participation in the workforce back in the 1970s, we really weren't that much far off from other countries, as I said, and even in, up to 1990, women's participation rate in the workforce was really near the top of the advanced OECD countries of 22 that we counted. But what we saw when we looked at the benefits that other governments have offered, let's just give you a list. Many of them started way early. Norway started in the 1950s. You have Sweden started in the 1950s. You have Canada was certainly advanced as well in the 1990s. We can go, the list goes on, and the point is that many, and I'm talking about paid maternity leave, also help with child care, with early childhood development, cash for care benefits for families of two-year-olds and on. A lot of steps have been taken in many other countries, and I think that's really what's kind of given them the step ahead in terms of retaining women in the workforce.
Great. We're going to try to move to a couple more live questions now. The first question is from Alexandra Smothers. Alexandra, your line should be open. Go ahead and introduce yourself. Let us know where you're calling from and ask your question.
Hi, good morning. This is Alexandra Smothers from Los Angeles. Thank you for this call today. It's extremely important and very powerful. I recently read The Feminine Mystique, and was written some time ago, but it focuses on the responsibility in many ways lying with us and changing our mindset that women are as lovable and feminine as ever when we leave the economy. And it does take shifting the psychology of women to choose to fully participate in the nation's economy. And my question is, how do we reinforce those positive images in women and create that shift? And I think it's happening to some degree, but how can we do it even more so? And also, I thank you for bringing up single parenting. I was a single mom. And single parenting has a much huger impact on the economy than we often take a look at. And I'm really grateful that you've presented that today and would also like to hear some more about that and how we can, I don't know, so, you know, encourage men to stand up and be fathers. But also for the women, you know, in this, how do we support them?
I thank you so much for giving me that question. I want to make sure I understood the question, and also that I have to give you, you know, so much credit for being able to manage work and your family as a single family. That is something that is so commendable. It's very, I can't imagine how hard that must have been, and it's really impressive that you were able to do that. I think you were talking about the line is not so great, so I just wanted to make sure I understood. So you were talking about sort of how women are perceived in the workforce. I believe that was what was part of the question, and then I think you mentioned choice to basically fully participate in the economy. How do we make it easier for women? How do we turn the story in terms of a woman's choice to fully participate into the economy a positive one? Am I correct on that, Liz? Did you?
Yeah, that's exactly what I heard. So I think she talked a little bit about the feminine mystique and, like you said, the kind of changing societal views of women's participation. And like you said, I think we're right on track.
Yeah, I think in terms of changing societal views on women in the workforce or women working at, say, higher levels or women taking careers to going into fields that were considered to be male-dominated fields, I think it's going to take some time. We've come a long way, baby, as some commercial had said once, but it is going to take some time in terms of changing the societal views of what is a woman's, you know, where is the woman's place in the workforce. I think it's a slow process, and we certainly have had some steps, but it's still going to take some time. And I really don't have any. I wish I had an anecdote, or a way of addressing those issues, but I just think it just takes time. But we have come a long way, that's for sure. In terms of where I think that starts, I think it starts at the work at the company. I think there the question of, I think we talked about earlier about how somebody might have asked that question in terms of how do companies get ahead of the curve in, you know, making it easier for women to basically continue to manage their household and be connected to the company so that they retain that woman after some of the major responsibilities of child care, for example, has passed. That's a win for the company in terms of being able to retain that woman, and certainly that woman will have much more loyalty to that company, but it also is good in terms of public relations for the world. I think that's a way to address the question of changing the societal mindset for what women's work should be. I think it starts at the corporate level, and then it expands.
We've got time for just a few more questions. Beth Ann and I talked about this a little bit before we joined all of you today, and I'd like to ask her this question because I think it was really helpful. Beth Ann, what role do you think the marriage penalty plays in this whole phenomenon of women maybe not staying in the workforce? My understanding is that couples who have similar salaries, so often more professional, higher income, two-income households, are often most affected by this. We just went through a big tax reform with the federal government. Was there a missed opportunity here? Can you explain what that is, if you think it had an impact, if you studied that, and what the possibilities might be moving forward?
Well, I think there, I do say, you know, in terms of the tax reform, one positive from the tax reform was it did, maybe not enough, but it did at least help in terms of some child care credits. So there was some help in terms of a woman being able to manage, or a family being able to manage, work and child care. But I think that, you know, there's many more steps we can take. The marriage tax penalty, I guess you could say. Now, I'm not a tax specialist, so take this for what it's worth. And if there's a tax specialist on the call, please, you know, hit that button, and we'd love to hear from you. But the idea behind it is that the idea behind it, and it still is, it wasn't addressed in the tax reform that just went through Capitol Hill, was that if you have a couple, say a man and a woman that are not married, have the same jobs as a couple, man and a woman that are married, that have the same jobs and the same income. Because of, I guess, the way the system is in terms of tying it to federal household income versus a separate single income, the married couple gets taxed more. I suppose this might also factor in, again, I'm not a tax specialist, but this also might be a play for same-sex couples as well. I'm not sure about that. But the married couple gets taxed more than the same couple making the same amount of money that happens to be single, not married. Maybe they live together, but they're not married, and so the married couple is penalized. We see this as one thing that's a disincentive for the person who makes less money to work. Because if they are being taxed more and they're making less money, it's one reason for that person to say, well, maybe it's not worth me staying in at my job. I think this would be a nice example for some kind of CBO-like score to measure the impact from the legislation that changes that. I'd also say, although I won't be able to give into too much detail, but I can suggest others if they're very interested in following this, I believe Canada has addressed the marriage tax penalty with positive results.
Great, thank you. We have a great email question here from Diana Johnson, who's from Newport News, Virginia, and it's a very specific question, so if it's out of the wheelhouse, that's fine, and we can move on, but I think it's a good follow-up to your point about the CBO score. Could we consider other economic indicators, like the genuine progress indication, when considering the impact of women choosing, or men, frankly, choosing families, choosing to stay home instead of pursue their professional career? Are there other indices like that that exist that you see as a valuable data resource?
So the question is that kind of tied to the CBO-like score we said in terms of how to measure it. I think the question was, other than economic factors that would measure this hypothetical CBO-like score in terms of assessing the impact of some kind of legislation on women's participation in the workforce, this question was, I believe you said genuine progress in terms of what was, I didn't quite understand the question. So
yeah, that's correct. I think you restated the question exactly. Are there other indicators? She specifically noted the genuine progress indication, which I'm not familiar with, but I think any wellness indicator that you think that there's data out there that you think would be a good measure, we'd love to hear about.
Well, I'm wondering in terms of that, again, this is all just sort of thoughts that it's just something that has not been developed. It's a really, we see this as really just a starting point to really get the discussion going. But other, in terms of wellness factors that you consider, you would consider, okay, so how would, and I believe there was also mention about what's the choice about men choosing to stay at home. I mean, that certainly is an option as well. How do you measure those choices that a family has to take or needs to take? We talked about such factors as childcare in terms of and what would be the impact on that kind of cost-benefit ratio for of how to factor in the cost of childcare and the choice to continue work. What about just in terms of well-being? When you think about, I think about the single mother that was just on the line, in terms of managing her work as well as managing her family. What if that, what if for a single parent, doesn't have to be a woman, it could be a single male parent that is managing their child or children and their work environment. If, could there be a factor in terms of measuring, if say there is a legislation that's being considered into law, what if we measured the well-being of people who, who have just a little bit more time to spend at home, a little bit more money to be able to take those vacations, or health benefits of that. I mean, in terms of the health benefits of being able to afford the child care as well as their work and have enough time to really take care of themselves as well. What are the health care costs in that? I don't know how that would be measured, but it's a thought.
Great. We have another question, an emailed question here from a woman named Trish Price in Seattle. She says, teacher pay is out in front right now, and your study noted that more women than men teach and that they are paid less for the amount of education they have compared to other workers in the other workers with the same level of education. What impact do you think teacher pay has on the gender pay disparity?
Well, when I think about this, I look at how I wonder if, and again, this deserves more research. So I'm coming up, it's a thought, but again, it does merit more real research. But I wonder if there is kind of a bias in terms of what we invest in and what we reward. I see teachers as really the teachers are the ones who basically teach our future leaders. That seems to be an incredible an achievement and something that should be well rewarded. You would also say that for child care providers as well, but yet child care providers are not really rewarded in terms of pay. I'm not sure where the disparity is or how this fits into the gender wage gap, but it is something that needs to be explored. I think that the gender wage gap goes a bit further than just that, although I'm not going to say that is not something that's a real crucial issue in terms of how you know, women-related fields, or women usually considered to be women-related fields like teaching or childcare, versus what we consider to be more, you know, male-dominated fields like STEM research and other more sciences, for example, you know, the gap there. But I would also go to the question of even women who explore men, you know, fields that would be considered to be male domain, even when women explore that, I think that time off penalty that I mentioned earlier also kind of makes the bars on that ladder even harder to climb.
Great. And we have another question here from LaTanya Harris in New York. How does the benefit to encouraging women to pursue STEM education and careers compared to the recent pushes for men to enter more stable fields traditionally held by women, for instance, the pink collar jobs like nursing, which, you know, as much as they don't pay as much as doctors, really do pay well?
I think in terms of the choice of fields that women and men consider, it's a choice that that a person makes. It's something that they decide in terms of what kind of career they want, how much time do they want to invest in that career, and how much time would that, you know, at home. So when I think of, how we see it as in terms of, you know, opening up opportunities. It's not necessarily that it's kind of a, you know, go steer towards this or go towards that. We really just see it that let's open the opportunities. Let's give women and men the choices in order to make a decision in terms of what they would like to pursue. And this doesn't start in college. This needs to start much earlier. This needs to start with our five-year-olds. I'll give you a personal anecdote. When I was a young kid, I was like 6 or 7 years old. I think I was in first grade. I did really well on math, my little math quiz, and I showed it to my mom, and my mom said, "Oh, well, that's great, but boys always do better than girls in the end." It's a bias. That was, I know, it's shocking, and I, of course, was very upset, and then I decided to go get my PhD in economics to prove her wrong. But I do think that there's a bias in terms of how we steer girls and boys along the way. I think, in terms of to that question, I think if men want to go into more stable fields like nursing, more power to them. Make those choices. Make that decision. I think that when we talk about a bias in terms of women, you know, are steered away for men-type fields like STEM, men are probably steered away too, and maybe that's not the choice they want to make. So I see it as much more of a, let's open the opportunities for people so that they can really pursue what they really want to do.
Great. Well, we just have time for one more question, and I agree on the encouragement as a little kid. I was lucky enough to have a mom for a math teacher, so that was helpful. But I think this is a great way to end. The retirement savings piece mentioned in your study is really interesting, and we already know that America doesn't have enough saved for retirement. And we're seeing here that, you know, women really do seem to do a better job of saving for their kids' education. And God knows, college education is skyrocketing like crazy. How much, by not investing in women right now, and how much is maybe too quantitative of a question here, but in what ways are we borrowing from the future? And what are some policy proposals that really could get us on track?
That's a great question. I wish I had all the answers to that. I can try. I can certainly try. As I mentioned, one thing is that, you know, we already said just actually making it easier for women. Investing in the women is also investing in those costs in terms of childcare and family care. And by the way, I want to say this is the 25th year of the Family Leave Act. It's the anniversary of the Family Leave Act, 25 years. I think maybe would be a really nice time to you know, maybe tweak it a little bit. And here's a good conversation to start that happening. But I do think not investing in women in terms of keeping it makes it harder for women to participate if they choose to. We were very clear to say that it's a choice that a woman and a family makes, you know, and there's other factors that are in play. But if a woman chooses to work, let's make it easier for them and not not investing in women in terms of investing in child care support or maternity or paternity support makes it that just much harder. So we lose that productivity from that woman, not just next year, but down the line. I think that in terms of it, we do a very simple analysis, as I mentioned, in terms of the impact on the economy, but we don't factor in the societal benefits that women offer. I don't know if I mentioned this earlier, but women, it's not just other societal benefits, but women, we decide not just the economic gains, but we save more and invest more. So what does that mean in terms of if we're investing in our children and that child, the productivity gains when we get from that future leader is also being lost if we can't invest as much as we would like to or we could have in the on the alternative.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. That is all the time we have for today. Thanks to all of you for taking time out of your schedule to join this call. And Beth Ann, especially thank you for the time to go over your study and take all these comments and questions, which maybe will result in some further study by you or somebody else. We will send a survey about the call out to everybody who participated, along with, as I mentioned, a link to the recording. Thanks again for joining us, and Beth Ann, especially thank you for your time, and we look forward to working with all of you again soon. Have a good
afternoon.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
That'll do it for us here at Business Forward. Thank you for listening, and thanks to Do Kashitiru for use of their song, Destination Not Specific, which is used under a Creative Commons license. You can hear more Creative Commons music at dig.ccmixter.org. Would you like to hear the next call live? Go ahead and sign up at businessfwd.org. Thanks so much.